קשה לי.
Okay,
I'm good.
My friend shot me a text this weekend, and he was like, great episode, referring to the last one. Then he said, but why didn't you guys sing Money, Money, Money by ABBA? Why didn't we sing Money, Money, Money by ABBA? That was clearly the ABBA song that we should have been singing. You brought this like B-wing ABBA song, one of us, one of them, one of we. I don't even know what song it was. Anyway, so we should have sang Money, Money, Money. Da 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 da. Today's episode is brought to us by us. If you'd like to sponsor us, get in touch. Welcome to October 7th Emotionally Raw Coverage. Today is March 25th. It's the 171st day of the war, and we have a very special guest in the studio. Joining us from Los Angeles, but here physically in Tel Aviv on this sunny Monday afternoon in Dora's apartment. Welcome, Ariel Jalali.
Hello, Dora. Hello, Amy. Happy to be here.
Welcome. Before we get into it, folks, I'm gonna read parts of, you know, his bio so you guys know who he is. To me, he's a friend, but he's also many other things, and it's worth knowing what those things are. So, Ariel is the CEO of Paragon Technology Solutions, a trusted technical advisor to private equity-backed and high-growth enterprise companies. Paragon specializes in AI transformation using practical data and AI ML to unlock efficiency and play Moneyball. Ariel has 25 years of experience in innovation and digital transformation. He's a renowned expert in AI, chatbots, and conversational commerce, and served as a technical advisor on chatbots at the first White House hackathon. Ariel also serves on advisory boards in the AI and data space. He's a sought-after speaker and thought leader in the industry with a proven track record, including founding Sensei and working across several industries and top Fortune 500 companies and governments. He shares his knowledge as a lecturer in AI ML at UCLA, has been featured in numerous publications and media channels, and is the author of the upcoming book, The Belonging Economy Model. Welcome.
Thank you. Wow, that's an impressive bio.
It is an impressive bio. Considering how much I've been talking to like AI, I mean, I wasn't really into AI, and then this podcast started and there was a lot of work to be done. And so I started working with ChatGPT.
Uh-huh. Or as we call him, Chad GPT, our trusty intern.
Sometimes I like all caps at Chad. Like one day if the AI will like rebel and turn against us, you know, they're going to like come at the door and be like, you were shouting at us in all caps. You're one of the first to go, you dumb bitch. You know, like I actually have this, you know, paranoid sort of fear.
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't after you.
True.
Yeah. Are you one of the please and thank you crowd?
I was at the beginning of my AI use, but then when they would start, you know, because the podcast, October 7th, Emotionally Raw Coverage. So I would like write these descriptions at the beginning, and then I was like using it as a linguistic tool. And then if anything had anything to do with current events, it was like, I cannot give you advice on terror. And I'm like, bro, if you've been paying attention, I'm not asking you for advice on terror. And then at one point, like 2 months in, it was just like, Hamas is considered a terrorist organization by some countries, but not all countries. And I was like,
can we have a list of those countries so we don't go there?
That's been a weird time.
Yeah. There's a lot of open the pod bay doors, Hal. And then there's a lot of, I can't do that, Dave, you know, with AI. But these are the times we live in.
It is a weird time. Like now, I mean, one of the mega threats that like Noriel Rubini talks about is like these deep fakes. And a lot of people have been talking about them, like deep fakes and like AI. And now like, I mean, there's so much fake news as it is like going on in the social media space. I bet you've been like thinking about so many different things related to AI.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Noriel Rubini is like the Chicken Little of technology. Every bit of technology frightens him, from Bitcoin to blockchain to AI to, you know, there's some people that sing the same song. You know, they're like wrestlers. They have their song, they sing it. But aside from that, I think that I worry a lot about deep fakes, but I come at it from a point of attribution. And attribution in AI is a topic that's really important to me because I think of AI as an aperture of us as humanity being able to trade our time for money, to earn money, and that aperture is rapidly closing. So in light of that, attributing your knowledge and your assets and things like that to AI that lives on is something that's going to be very important to the future of earning and living and that sort of thing.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so future of labor concerns, but what about like misinformation? I mean, we're seeing you're in Los Angeles, like you're in some of the thick of it of, I mean, we're here, we've discussed this on the pod when Ben Glebe came in, you know, and he lives in LA and it was just like, on the one hand, it's been really hard living here, especially those first few months. On the other hand, I can't even, I'd be like pulling my hair out there. Like the things that you're being exposed to probably in your own circles. I mean, how has that been for you? You're a really proud Zionist.
I am. I have this radical belief that the Jewish people have a right to exist in their own land, which in recent times is quite out there. But I think we transitioned from the fakeness to the hatred, and there is kind of a Venn diagram overlap between the two. But in terms of the fakeness, I feel like the very same technology that can determine fake versus generated AI-based content versus organic content is the same technology that protects the writers, its attribution, protects plagiarism. It's all the same. It's all the same shebang. And once we crack one nut, we've cracked them all. But the hatred is something else. That's much more existential and goes back across millennia.
Yeah, it's true. It's like the hatred's always been there, you know, or the talks about all the anti-Semitism on social media. I think Sam was saying, like, I don't know if it made it into the episode, but anti-Semitism wasn't invented like after Instagram. You know, it's been around for millennia. So we can keep talking about these like surface level kind of, not permutations, but like occurrences of what's happening. And we can keep like, you know, kind of whacking the mole on it, or we can get to the source, to the heart of it, or we can just say it is what it is and it's always kind of been there and let's focus on other things, you know?
I go through waves. You know, there was if somebody calls you a pig, you can either point out that you don't have a snout or you can just get on with your life. And I and a lot of people I know go through these waves of wanting to disprove things and prove things and just getting on with life. And I think that there's a litany of historical data points on the Jews being able to just play the long game and get on with life. Nobody gets on with life the way that we do. So here we go.
How are you finding, this is your second trip since October 7th, right? Out here?
Yeah, I was here in November where things were very emotionally raw, but there was a very somber mood. And there still is, but now there's, you know, with Purim, I think people are just forcing themselves to get on with life. And I know that it's hard, but it's important. I know that it's different because I was here I was here before November a year ago, before my first trip this year. And the way that people drive here is very emblematic of something being drastically wrong. They're typically very aggressive drivers. You know, if they see you leaving a car's length, they'll very quickly close that car length. The thing I noticed that's different this year is that they're not honking as they do that. There's kind of this very quiet, I don't know if it's respect or if it's just this somber mood, but there's definitely some sense of there's something different.
Interesting. I think people are kind of exhausted.
It's exhausting playing the long game inside of the long game. It's like a Matryoshka doll of long game.
Like you get inside and then you're like, oh, wait, more things, more challenges, more obstacles. You thought that you had arrived at like a little plateau. Nope.
Nope. Mm-mm.
That was a carpet under your feet. Now we're going to drop 200 meters. Boop. Another setback. Wait, but you just set back.
Yeah.
The cadence of my life feels that way, at least on a personal, professional, every sort of level.
It's a lot.
And when do you test a person? Do you test them when they're up or do you test them when they're down?
you test them when they're neutral, and then you make them go down, and then you see how they react to that, and then you take them all the way to the top, and you see how they react to that. That's, I mean, we have stories in the Bible and all, like, you know, like Eov or Job, right? You know, that person was tested. Joseph was tested at the very top of his game, you know, being the man in Egypt. But it's important to, you know, it's important to go through the ups and the downs and keep the long game in mind. The Babylonian exile was 3,500 years. Like, the Iraqi Jews finally came out after 3,500 years. I mean, there are no other people that have that kind of a long game.
It's crazy how, I was just speaking with a friend who's Iranian Jewish, like Persian Jewish. She was born there, and like, her family had been there for thousands of years. Yeah. I think so many people, like, in terms of where there was staying power for Jews after the exiles, like, they were in these Middle Eastern countries, and so many people out in the States don't even know that there are, like, Middle Eastern, Far Eastern Jews. It's like, oh, you guys are white. You guys are white. I mean, your family, do you want to tell us where your family's from?
Yeah. I mean, it actually starts with Persian Jews. My great-grandfather was the son of a rabbi in a small sea town called Bushehr. And his father said, listen, there's too many mouths to feed here, and there's a lot of persecution. Why don't you get on that boat over there and go to India and see if you can make something happen? If you can make some money, try to bring some of your siblings with you. So he gets on a boat at age 12, lands in Pune, and ends up making the little hats that Nehru used to wear. And, you know, long story short, family ends up becoming, you know, pretty settled in India. And then when State of Israel was formed, they came and they made Aliyah. They moved to Rishon and helped build things up. So full circle.
So you're an Indian Jew.
I'm a Jew. I believe in tags, not taxonomy. So I think Instagram has it right. You know, you could have a tag of, you know, Jew plus Indian plus AI plus, as opposed to, you know, trying to put someone in a very rigid taxonomy.
That's lovely. I love that.
So Dor's hand, I wasn't sure, you know, if he was going to bring it down upon us.
Dor uses his hands. Do you want to talk?
I'm watching him.
Do you have anything to say?
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge, so today's episode is sponsored by this lovely carrot cake that Dor gave me, and it's yummy, and it's my favorite kind. So thank you, Dor.
You're welcome.
It's that flow state we were talking about earlier.
Everything is flowing. It's all coming up roses.
My question is, and it's maybe like, it's a discussion, it's not a question. I spent some time in India, and it's a place that, I don't know if I will, even in Hebrew, it will be hard to explain what I want to say, but, you know, it's a quest when you're there. You know, it feels like there is a mark question above your head. And this is kind of a special moment. We are in, this is kind of the last episode. We take a break. We don't know what's going to happen. But of this phase that we run in since October 7, like, this is the end of the road. And I actually started to talk, but I don't have a question. But, like, what's going to happen? Like, should we keep going with this?
So I have a comment on your question. So one of the things that I learned very early in conversational AI, I consider myself one of the world experts in that. Because of Google search, the world is focused on questions and answers, search and result, right? Mm-hmm. That's the paradigm with which we see technology. However, when you flip that into a chatbot, one of the hardest things that users have with GPT is that it's a conversation. And so when I launched my previous company, we had this chatbot, and everybody thought that they were going to answers from it, the way that you get answers from, you know, like a magic crystal ball, you know, like, what's the answer? 42, right? But the best answer to a question is another question, which is really a conversation. So the answer to your question is not an answer, but it's another question. Where do you want to take the conversation?
Like, specific. This conversation or like...
No, the conversation with a big C.
What I want to say is the best lesson I had, I've been having, I don't know how to say that, is that before we started doing that, I had this dream of like, go away from here. And since we started the podcast, I really understand that in a good way, we stuck here. Like Tel Aviv is really good solution. My question is someone abroad find this dialogue of this niche group of some, I don't know, semi-Jewish, hipster, Zionist speaking about whatever we speak about? This is my question.
So one of the things, if you build technology products, and I just met someone recently who's, you know, built things at Google, et cetera. Those of us that build products are always amazed because it's always like SETI, S-E-T-I, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Remember that movie with Jodie Foster where she has the satellite dishes in the desert and she's putting out the signal like, will somebody hear us? Will somebody hear? So there are all these crazy people that are actually looking for aliens and they're mm-hmm. broadcasting out into the darkness, hoping one day that there'll be a signal that comes back or that's interpreted. And I don't know, I think publishing is an act of faith. So I think the two of you are very spiritual people at some level.
Publishing is act of faith.
Yeah, really you don't know who's listening.
Good name for an album.
Yeah, by George Michael.
There is one?
You gotta have faith.
Ah,
but listen,
what
getting,
a song.
Getting back to the product managers, you know, eventually you'll run data and I think that you'll see that you have tons of people from all over the world, from places you never thought that they would be listening to you, that they're getting the signal and for some reason they're tuning in. And, you know, this is not just podcasts, but like, you know, social products, enterprise products. You never really, it's a grand experiment. And then you look at the data to see where the people are, where the users are. Funny thing is in our industry, we call them users. And in your industry, you call them
listeners.
Same thing.
Avoiding the elephant in the room. You ask about the future. He asks you what you want from the future. You take it somewhere else. And then when I call you out on it, you're like, oh no, we're going to do a music transition. And you can answer for both of us. Not only a deflection of the question, but like actually like, Amy, answer the question for us. I don't know. I am learning how to hold on and let go at the same time. And I don't know where things go from here. I don't know. I'm continually amazed. And also just kind of like in this weird apathy of like listlessness that I wake up to in the mornings recently. And then, you know, I go about my day and I put one foot in front of the other, but it's this track jump that happened. And I don't even feel comfortable being like, oh, I have PTSD from this war. It's not like I was at Nova and I wasn't in Gaza and I wasn't serving now and I don't live in the South and I wasn't displaced from the North, still displaced from the North. In many ways, I'm living this in the most privileged way possible. And I don't allow myself to even give it that place, but it's, I don't know. The intersection of living through this during this wider global time, the future of labor thing, really, I feel it on a personal level. And I've been very worried about it for the past decade as like, that's one of our key crisis points in humanity. You know, we can keep like saying, oh my God, this technology is amazing. And so much of it is. And yes, definitely when radio came about and when, you know, records came about and every time that there's been a new technology, there have been people saying, oh my God, that's exciting, but what's the downsides of it? I don't know. So I don't know where we go from here is my answer. Maybe it is just a matter of having faith that things just kind of evolve on their own and you just give it the best you got.
We've been asking this question about the future of labor for so long, we've forgotten about the future of capital. And I'm an unabashedly a capitalist in the best sense of the word. I feel like the future of work is actually less working. Like, we needed work to produce some efficiencies and we needed to produce things. But in the end, if we have, you know, robots doing a lot of these things, you know, from flipping hamburgers to stacking pallets in a warehouse, do we really need to do those grunt jobs? Do we really need to, do we need to be in labor or do we need some dignified means of earning? And I just skip right ahead and say, okay, what's the most dignified way to earn? And that's really through ownership of assets. So I think the future of labor is really the future of capital. And I look at it from a capitalist free market lens as opposed to a socialist communist lens. I'm not so worried about, I'm not obsessed with the labor aspect of it. I'm obsessed with the human purpose and human dignity aspect of it.
I guess my concern is also the human purpose thing, but also like that Sade song, just the quote of it, but how am I going to make a living? You know what I mean? Like, I think about like, how are people going to like buy things? Like, what are they going to go to the market and buy bread with? You know, how are they going to earn that? Will there be room for everyone to earn?
I think yes. I think that part of the solution, this is something that I'm exploring in my writing, is to imagine new types of asset classes that still fit within the market and the capitalist structure, but have a low enough price point that average people can buy into them. One of the things that I'm really obsessed about are the new grids that are going to run the world, the new energy grids, the new logistics grids. And these are massive investments. We're talking about things in the multi-trillions of dollars. I think that the capital class that exists now, it will behoove them to democratize access to those assets for people to buy in. And the way to do that is for us to collectively buy things together. It sounds a little bit like a digital kibbutz, but it involves people actually paying into things and owning things together, you know, that are quite large. A quick example is, you know, Tesla has a mega pack battery that costs $12 million and it could power several neighborhoods in Tel Aviv if the lights went out. You know, you have two options. A big company can own that $12 million battery, several of them, or you can have fractional ownership of that thing. Or you can have fractional ownership of the next self-driving grids or the energy grids or the next systems that power the world, you know, post-industrial age. And I really see that being the next era of growth. And I think people will take purpose in that. And it'll free up your actual time to do other things when you're making money in your sleep.
I love how you talk about the future with such curiosity and optimism. Lately, I've been harangued by not only depressions, which are linked to the past, but anxieties, which are linked to the future. And so for me, thoughts of the future, it's like they're hand fellows. I feel like I just made up a term, but they're always there with anxieties. Anxieties and future are always together. It's like, is there a way of thinking about, and then, you know, everyone's like, just think in the present, right? So I try to think in the present and then I avoid thinking about the future, but you go at the future with like, I don't know. I started reading Moby Dick over the weekend. It's so weird. And in one sense, I feel like so many things are falling apart or fraying in like every sphere of my life, like dominoes just crashing. On the other hand, things feel really new, like I'm creating more or I'm overcoming my own like sort of, oh my God, you'll never be able to understand Moby Dick. You know, like Moby Dick has always intimidated me. It's like Crime and Punishment. I haven't read that. And then I found myself just grabbing it off the library shelf on Saturday. And Moby Dick, like, you know, it's like a whaling ship. There's like these maps and illustrations at the beginning. And he's going to go out to meet the water. And there's these descriptions of the water at the beginning as this, like, you know, everyone, Manhattan or whatever, goes out to look at the sea. And people are filled with such curiosity. And it's a meditation. And then these people like went out to meet the ocean. People went out to discover the new world, and you go out to meet the future, like with open arms. You're just like with your tongue out, like catching the raindrops of the future. And I'm just like, have you always felt this way about the future and technology and like this optimism? And is there a way of bottling it up and maybe injecting me with it after we're done recording today?
Wow. That's a lot. Well, you know, Moby Dick is actually starts off with curiosity and exploration, but it turns into obsession. And it's the dark side of purpose, actually, is the takeaway that I have. Spoiler alert. For those of you that haven't read the book, Moby Dick, the guy gets very obsessed. Doesn't work out so well for him. But no, listen, for somebody who's studying purpose, there's perhaps not a better book than that. I wanted to rewind a little bit about what you said about anxiety. Let me ask you a question, perhaps rhetorical. Is it possible to be afraid of something you know about deeply? Or do we fear the unknown?
In a sense, I feel like we bring the past into the present, and then we also engage with that discourse when looking out at the future. I occupy a very beautiful spectrum of, you know, mental whatever, that's like depression and anxiety for me go hand in hand. Some people just get the depression. Some people just get the anxiety. For me, they're like wedded. So I'm occupying several timelines at the same time. You know, it's like when you've lost someone you love, they've crossed to the other side and you make them alive. You alive them every time that you think about them or talk to them or whatever, you see them in something, they're no longer dead. You made them alive. And so there's this thing that we do when we're like afraid of the unknown, we're bringing so much of our awareness of the past. And then even when you think that you're not doing it, it's so hard to stay so genuinely open as if you've buried the past.
Yeah. Well, it all depends on how you relate to what is the past and what is the future. I think that one of the exercises that helps me is to Dor's point of trying to get away. Getting away is, for me, not a place that I'm getting away from, but a time that I'm getting away from. So one of the things that I think that we struggle with in humanity is the linear nature of time. And we're bred with this as kids through our stories, you know, once upon a time, ... happily ever after. We have this very linear view of time with a rising action and a descending action. But I think one of our collective challenges is going to be seeing things in multidimensional space and time. That's the next challenge for humanity. And I think if you can step outside of that, you can put certain unknown things into boxes. You can say, look, listen, I don't know exactly what happens in this box, but let's move past it or above it. And you can move in different dimensions and looking at a problem.
We're seeing that with storytelling, right? Like we're seeing people really breaking through like narrative structures in TV and film, or that book that I recently read. I mean, that was from the 70s, but it was so daring in the sense that it was stream of consciousness. And what I saw that, hats off to the English translator of that text, Past Continuous by Yaakov Shabtai, but it linked past and future and the present in a way that I've never seen anyone being able to do before. It was almost seamless, you know, like he's at the cafe and the coffee's about to land and then we're inside of a memory inside of it. But to pull that off in a movie is pretty easy, but to pull that off on the page is very difficult to do with it staying engaging and having people be clear about it. And we've spoken about it before, like, is there a new form of media or a new form of, you know, leaving aside storytelling for a second, is there a new way of transmitting the news or a new way of having social media or some sort of new format? That was a question that you had asked a few months ago when we were speaking. And it was like, is there some new way of operating that would combine that sort of like, let's blow through the misconception of the linearity of time or like the sort of linear progression of humanity, quote unquote, which I'm all for as an anthropologist at heart. So it's like,
this is a difficult problem. And when I encounter difficult problems, the first thing I do is I try to build a framework with which to think about the problem. And there are multiple frameworks that are possible here. But I kind of like what we talked about earlier about the inside out and the outside in. I suspect that there's a framework around turning passive listeners into users. You know, the technology world sees an audience as a user, somebody that interacts with a system and acts upon it and is acted upon. Unfortunately, or fortunately, all of the generations of media where you go from, you know, Gutenberg press to radio to television, which was just basically like moving pictures and radio to internet, even the business models that came with them. There was a great article in The Atlantic called Why Advertising Was Internet's Original Sin. And it's because they had this notion of a broadcast media, where what we're learning now is the future of media is not really advertising, it's transactional. So the framework that I would use to think about this problem is, how do we turn our listeners into users, and how do we turn advertising into transactions? And maybe in that scenario, we don't need any more sponsors.
I feel some sort of social anxiety in a crowd that I didn't feel for a while. Like I used to go out and party on Purim, or I would go to bars or whatever. And lately I'm really in my studio at home, or having like one-on-ones, or meeting just a few people. And it's interesting because one-on-ones are great. This is great. This is like one and the universe, right? And then there's the stuff that happens in the middle. Like this is one in the universe, and then it'll go online. And I feel free here in a sense. Like it's one-on-one, one in the universe. Those are like the same in a weird way. And then there's the middle that gets really messy for me. I don't know if that's... if that makes any sense. But here I feel like it's really pure. I feel as if I'm at home and with my fabrics, and that what I'm releasing into the world is something that I'm comfortable with it. I'm comfortable doing it. Am I a freak? Do I make any sense?
No, I don't think you're a freak. I think you're an ambivert. And so am I, and so are a lot of people. It's like, what is that Ralph Waldo Emerson quote about it's easy to live in society's opinion, it's easy to live inside of a crowd with the crowd's opinion, but the perfect person is he who in the midst of a crowd keeps his own, you know, keeps his nose. I don't know, I'm screwing up the quote, but it has to do with self-reliance. And I don't think this is actually a one-to-many format. I think what's cool about this, it's a one-to-one format. And then that one-to-one format has a bunch of voyeurs. And then may spark some other conversations or things like that. But
if I know that it's going to be broadcast, then I'm not really being one-to-one. I mean, I am being one-to-one, but it's like...
But you haven't broken the third wall?
I mean, yeah, it's like, you know how with some people, you're not how you would be with others? There are very few instances where I would be very different.
There will be time, there will be time.
It's interesting to like... I don't know, open yourself up. It goes back to the vessel. I talked about the vessel in the first episode or the second episode. That's how I felt when I sat down on the couch that day on October 7th when we met and he invited me over, and the apartment was arranged differently. The couches were there. We used to record over there. And I sat down and he put the headphones on me. It was the first time I'd been on a podcast even. And I remember just a portal appearing and then walking through.
Wow. One of the things that I was thinking about as you were speaking is this notion of a persona versus a person. And that's something I try to separate out. I think that a person is a composite of multiple personas that are living on our fleshy hardware. And so I feel like the persona of Amy and Dor that do the podcast are very different than the other multiple personas that you might have. And I think that it's important, especially with technology, to capture the idea of these individual and distinct and vibrant personas. One of the things that really bothers me currently about the state of social media is the cancellation of a person writ large, their entire personhood with all of their personas, just because you don't agree with one of their personas, you cancel the entire person. That's really problematic. I think that one of the positive things to be optimistic about is technology's ability to let us express ourselves in our various distinct personas. And there might be an outgoing persona in us. There might be an introverted persona. What is that famous poster? Introverts of the world, unite at home by yourselves.
It's funny to like sit across from you on the podcast and talk because we've been chatting for months. Like we met in real life last week, finally, but we've been chatting for months. I met you through my sister. We WhatsApp a lot and there's VMs and there's been so much. I've learned so much. And then it's like, what goes in a conversation that's like, what's the frame? And now, and then I guess the thing that's always consistent with the frame is Dor playing maestro and saying, oh, well now the frame is going to start winding down to a close. So there's that. It's like, what's the real world limitation and where does that meet that endless flow, if you will? And then the question to you is, what do you want to talk about that we haven't talked about? I mean, we've talked about so many things like over the past few months, but like, what would you like to talk about now on air? You see, this is what happens when I don't come with paper, but he's also very happy about this. It's very like improvisational. So
it's raw and live. Well, this is how the original radio was. There weren't scripted shows. And they just kind of flowed. I guess I would be curious. Israel is such a wonderful and fascinating place to be in Tel Aviv at this time. And in many ways, it's kind of like the startup nation, right? But it's also got this incredible history that goes back, and it's got an incredible future, I believe, especially in the region of leadership, thought leadership, technology leadership. I guess my question for discussion would be, what are we hopeful about? You know, we talked about the future. We understand there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of unknowns. But if we could hit fast forward and if magic fairies could come tonight, you know, and give us a Purim miracle and all of those issues were resolved to the best possible way and we could move forward 10 years into the future, what does Tel Aviv look like? What does our world look like? What is the best possible scenario that we could imagine?
I'm not feeling the most hopeful today, having my own crisis of faith. But what jumps out to me is, I guess, the same impulse that attracted me to the city and kept me here, which is that it's a combination. It's like the spirit of the people here. It's people that really care and like care. I mean, such care. They care about whether it's not necessarily like caring in the way that we think about in like American speak. I'm saying like they could be caring about what they're studying or what they're researching or what they're working on or what they're building or their music, but they also care in terms of like the distance between people here is so much shorter, I think, than what I've experienced anywhere else in the world. And before I got here, I also like lived briefly in Buenos Aires and like was traveling about quite a bit. And here it's like there isn't as much of that bullshit between people. It's like very much open. And so when we talk about like a depression or a suppression of spirit, I mean, that has an impact. It has an impact on people's ability to like care and connect. So I guess my hope is that we're able to bounce back.
Right. One of the special things I experienced yesterday was I went to a friend's house for Purim. And in the middle of the whole thing, the neighbor announced that his kid had finished a masechet and you know, studying the Talmud. And then everybody took a conga line from one house to the next house. And we partied over there. And when we came, the conga line came back and we partied back. And this idea of neighbors and intimacy and being connected to one another is an important thing. Like, I remember, you know, our neighbors in India were our family. I got on a plane and I flew for my neighbor's wedding. And everyone in America were like, it's crazy. Why are you going for your neighbor's wedding? What's that all about? But I think that some of the secret here to unlock is how do we use technology to scale that intimacy that we feel? And I think it will be possible, just like we train models now to produce human-like responses. I think that the EQ component of that in terms of belonging, and little plug for my book, The Belonging Economy. I feel like we could study the belonging that exists here between communities and neighbors and scale that for the future. And that's a very hopeful message.
So whereas almost everyone views like technology as anathema to intimacy and connection, you're hopeful about the possibility of technology actually integrating networks of intimacy and care and being able to bolster it somehow.
I've seen it firsthand at a certain scale. I built a product at one point that had 1 million users that were strangers connecting one-on-one and being quite lovely to each other, not trolling. There was very little hate. It's not really possible to hate someone one-on-one. I forget the axiom or whatever, but once you get to know someone one-on-one, it's different than when there's a peanut gallery, which is what exists now in social media. So that's sort of like that connection that exists is really important. I mean, the current version of AI is nothing more than classification and routing. And that's something humans do very well. Like, what is this thing or who is this person? And how do we route the conversation? How do we route the connection that we have to one another? So I think if we can scale those things, we're looking at a pretty exciting world.
You remember the end of Notting Hill? If you haven't seen Notting Hill, for fuck's sake, I don't know, like, you deserve the spoiler, but at the end of Notting Hill, when there's Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts are at that like press conference scene, and then there's a word that she like answers the reporter when the reporter's like, how long will you be in London? And she's like, oh, I'm leaving. And then Hugh Grant shows up and like the whole thing. And then the reporter asks the question again. And then she says, and how long will you be staying in London? And she says, indefinitely. And I remember watching it in middle school and being like, indefinitely, indefinitely, such a great word. It's like unknown, I guess.
You know what's cool about indefinitely?
What's cool about indefinitely?
It reminds me of the word invaluable.
Oh yeah, right? It has that thing. Like it seems to be like a negation, but it ends
like
up being better. It sounds like a nay, but it ends up being a yay.
Yay.
That's me trying to embrace a yay with a nay inside of it. That's really who I am at heart. You know, I have these like bright and bubbly spots, but deep down there's a nay. And the brightness isn't just like a, ooh, she got it. Like she's flaunting it. You work at it.
Two wrongs don't make a right. You know what two rights make?
A U-turn?
An airplane.
Huh? The Wright brothers. Folks, we're taking a break for an indefinite period. I don't know how long that is. Maybe it's weeks. Maybe it's a month. Maybe it's more than a month. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to eat later today. I don't know how I'm going to feel when I wake up tomorrow morning. I don't know how this is going to meet you, whether it's going to meet you at night or in the morning, whether you're going to like it, whether you're not going to like it. But I do know that we still, throughout all this time, will have a Gmail account and an Instagram and a YouTube channel. And if you miss us, you can write to us. And if you feel like being a supporter, you can do that too over at our Patreon. Get in touch. We would love to hear from you now more than ever. Also, we have a website. Send it around. If you're like, oh, this would make a great fit for blah, 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 send it. Send it to Larry David. Send it to Howard Stern. Send it to everyone. Send it to your mother. Send it to your cousin. Send it to your ex. I don't know. Just send it out. And this is me saying goodbye for now and not melting down on the air. So stay safe.
And stay tuned.